Hello everyone, I hope you're having a fantastic week so far. My name's Hayley Sparks and welcome to the Travel Podcast. We have got a great episode for you today. I am joined by Holly Brown from Inside Travel and we're going to be talking all about Japan. Now, Japan is a bucket list destination for so many of us and at the moment it is really, really popular. Holly, welcome to the Travel Podcast. How are you?
Yes, very well. Thank you. Thank you ever so much for having me. It's my first podcast experience, so I'm very excited to be on board.
Oh, brilliant. Well, we're excited to have you. And I can't wait to dive into this episode about Japan. It is a bucket list destination for me. It's somewhere that I haven't been yet. And I'm sure so many of our listeners feel the same. It's a destination that they're really intrigued by, or for some people it might be somewhere that they haven't considered and they don't know enough about. But everybody that I've spoken to who has visited Japan say it is breathtaking, it is beautiful, it is unique, it is so inspiring. So I really hope that we can get that across today. But Holly, let's start. If you could just tell our listeners a little bit more about you and your role at Inside Travel.
I'm Holly from Inside Travel. I am currently the business development manager, so I'm working very closely alongside all of our trade partners, specifically not just travel. But I've been with Inside Travel for just over 7 years now, and I spent 6.5 of those years working as a travel consultant. So if you had an inquiry with us and you were calling the other end of the phone, it was probably me you spoke to, giving you all of my nuggets of wisdom about Japan. But prior to working for Inside Travel, I actually spent 2 years living in Japan. So it's one of the prerequisites for all of our travel consultants to have lived or worked in the destinations that we sell. So we've got really in-depth knowledge of Japan from kind of the very rural reaches, which is where I lived, all the way through to kind of your classic sites like Tokyo, Kyoto. So we've got extensive knowledge of all of the areas of Japan.
Brilliant. Well, we're very lucky to be able to chat to you today. So let's start off. I really just want to ask you, what is it in sort of a summary that makes Japan so unique and so different to any other destination around the world?
Yeah, I think Japan is just so unlike anywhere else, and particularly even compared to a lot of its Asian neighbours. So its geographical neighbours are sort of South Korea and China, but Japan itself is an island nation. And I guess in a similar way to the UK and Europe, how we have a slightly different identity and we're a bit separate from the rest of Europe, I'd say that Japan is quite similar in that it's quite different from the rest of Asia. And because they're an island, they don't have any physical borders, which means they've been able to cultivate an incredibly strong kind of customs, culture and traditions that don't have the influence that that other Asian countries may get.
So Holly, for first-time visitors to Japan, what would you say are maybe the top three destinations that they should visit?
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult to choose three, but I think that with Japan, you always want to get a sense of bright lights and big city. So Tokyo, 100%. Ticks that box. And for most people, it's going to be their entry and exit point to Japan. Similar to London, so many different districts and areas to explore. You've got the more traditional district of Asakusa with its famous temple Sensoji. And then you've got the utter madness that is Shinjuku, which is all of your kind of skyscrapers, neon lights, people around at all hours. Yeah, I think Tokyo is definitely one of the top places to visit. But saying that, it's so unlike the rest of Japan. Japan is 70% sort of mountains and countryside, so it is actually a very rural destination outside of the main cities. So with that in mind, somewhere like Hakone, which is in the foothills of Mount Fuji. That's a really beautiful place to stay and a really nice antidote to the craziness of Tokyo. You've got traditional accommodations, which are fed by thermal hot springs. So all the properties there have hot spring baths, so you can sort of sit back and relax and enjoy some of the rural scenery. And if you're lucky, and if the weather is good, then you might catch a glimpse of Mount Fuji. And then I would also have to say Kyoto as the third place. Kyoto is really the traditional heart of Japan. It's where you'll find the geisha community, so lots of the beautiful kind of wooden structures and tea houses, cobbled streets, lots of the ancient shrines and temples, traditional Japanese gardens. So if you're really interested in history and immersing yourself in traditional Japanese culture, then Kyoto cannot be missed.
I love the fact that you've got three really different places to visit that offer opposite ends of the scale. Like you said, from Tokyo, all of the bright lights and the craziness, and then to have that tradition, you know, to be able to see the traditional geishas and things like that must be an incredible contrast to have one destination that offers so much.
Exactly that. And I think that's one of the things, Japan is such a country of contrasts. Tokyo is so hectic and modern in some respects, but then so much of the rest of Japan is very rooted in traditions, is incredibly rural. And it's just amazing to see the different aspects all kind of in this giant melting pot of what makes Japan.
Just so exciting and such a great place to visit. Holly, I find Japanese culture so fascinating. So shall we dive into that a little bit more? What can you tell us, having lived there for a couple of years? But just actually, first of all, I'm just interested to know why you decided to live in Japan for that period of time.
Yeah, of course. So I was graduating from university with a history degree, which left me with no clear career options, and I'd always had a real passion for travel, so I thought it would be a fantastic opportunity to combine living abroad somewhere but also with working rather than just backpacking. So I applied to something called the JET program, which is where you teach English in Japan, and I was lucky enough to go through their incredibly rigorous process of application, interviews at the Japanese embassy, terrifying people in suits, and then found out that I had been successful. And like any person in their mid-20s, you have big visions of being in the bright lights, big city, having a great time. But you don't actually get a choice on where you're placed. And I was placed in a really rural corner of Kyushu, which is in the south of the country. And incredibly beautiful scenery, surrounded by rice paddies, kind of mountains, the sea. So incredibly stunning scenery, but just not that many people. So it was quite a baptism by fire, having no Japanese language ability and being placed somewhere quite isolated where not that many other Westerners were, or where there not that many people actually spoke English. But actually, I'm so grateful for it because it gave me such an immersive experience of Japan. I got to truly understand Japanese culture, just the kindness of the people, how willing they are to go out of their way to help you, even when there is a language barrier. And actually, if I were to do it again, I'd probably want to go back to somewhere nice and beautiful and rural rather than be in the midst of a city where you can be in a bit of a bubble. So I'm always a huge advocate for visiting some of the lesser reached areas of Japan, because I think it gives you the true experience.
Be thrown in the deep end, sink or swim.
Absolutely.
And you obviously swam with the help of the lovely people, it sounds like, who, as you say, went out of their way to help you. And that's fantastic. So it must have been a bit of a culture shock then, Holly, for you, especially at that age when presumably, you know, you'd only seen so much of the world at that point.
Yeah, it was certainly a culture shock from not having any idea what was going on when anyone was conversing with you. Japanese culture is really based on or Japanese language is really based on set phrases. So every time you walk into a shop, whether it's a convenience store or a restaurant, there's just everyone who works there will yell out "Irashaimase," which means welcome. And to the uninitiated ear, you just think, why are all these people yelling at me? This is terrifying. But actually, they're just welcoming you to the shop. So it took a few months for me to figure out what was being said and what all the different phrases were. And then you just realize that everything is so set on amazing hospitality and service. And everyone's just kind of there to really kind of help you to feel at ease. But when you first arrive, it's certainly a culture shock.
Well, definitely different to, for example, places in the UK where people tend to put their head down when they walk past you and not necessarily engage. So that's really interesting. What other aspects of the culture did you find a little bit of an adjustment for you, Holly?
Yeah, I found that although everyone thinks of Japan as an incredibly modern country, there are so many elements that are so traditional. So when I lived there, it was very much a cash-based society. So I had a bank account, but I didn't have a bank card. I didn't pay for anything by card in the entire 2 years that I lived there. So all of my my rent, my bills, my council tax, everything was paid for in cash. And not only was it paid for in cash, I paid for it in cash at the convenience store, as that's where most people did their banking. So it's so different. And I think everyone thinks of the neon lights of Tokyo and skyscrapers and it all being a bit Blade Runner-esque. But actually, there's so many traditional aspects of the country. And I think that money is one of those things, which is quite a contrast to somewhere like South Korea, which is very much cashless. So if you go to South Korea, then it's quite unusual for people to use physical money. Everything's done by card or apps. Whereas even still in Japan now, most places will be cash transactions as opposed to card. It has changed a little bit during the pandemic with accommodations or bigger department stores, bigger restaurants taking card, but the majority of your transactions there will still be in cash. And I don't know about you, but I never ever carry any cash on me in the UK. I'm lucky if I've got 20p in my purse.
I know, unless I'm going to a dinner or something where I know they might be raising money for charity, I'll make the effort to get cash in my purse. But other than that, I just am exactly the same. So that is a really brilliant tip that's so worth knowing for travellers, to make sure that they will have access to cash when they're there, so they don't they don't run into any challenges or difficulties.
Exactly. And I say it has become a bit more common to use card, but it tends to be for bigger transactions. But I always kind of give people the tip of take enough money to cover maybe your first 5 days or so. And then it is really easy to take cash out when you're there. So if you do need to take any more out, then there's international ATMs at most of the convenience stores or at Japan Post offices. So don't stress, you're not going to be completely stuck, but just take enough to cover your first few days.
Great advice. Holly, now I know Japan is known for these unforgettable experiences, whether it's the bullet train journeys or the tea ceremonies, but are there any other kind of under the radar experiences that you'd like to share with our listeners that you would recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reason that so many people go to Japan is the food. It has some of the best food in the world. And when I go, I just like to gorge myself. And I think that there's such variety to food culture in Japan. It's not just all sushi, which is the kind of a misconception about Japan. Ooh. People don't eat sushi every day. They tend to eat sushi as special occasion meals. But so I think things like food experiences, food tours are so valuable for traveling, and they can really help you help to introduce you to the different food cultures, whether that's kind of izakaya pubs, which are I suppose it's the Japanese equivalent of like a tapas bar. So people will sit and drink, and they'll have like small plates of food. The menus are always in Japanese. They're incredibly difficult to navigate, but with someone there as a food tour, it can help to put you at ease, help you to try some things that you perhaps would have never considered trying before. You wouldn't have necessarily know what they are. All the way through to street food tours, like Osaka, for example, is known as Japan's kitchen, and it's got so many great casual dining places. So being able to navigate that with a guide, whether it's in a private tour or group tour, can really help you to sort of eat your way through Japan so that you can learn a little bit more beyond sushi. And I always say with Japan, Japanese food in particular, it can be quite overwhelming and it can be quite daunting. But if you don't have any particular allergies or dietary preferences, just try things and ask what they are afterwards. You're never quite sure what you're eating. And sometimes you wouldn't want to eat it if you knew what it was. But just try it. And you might just discover your next favorite food.
Exactly. Have an open mind.
Absolutely.
Holly, I know Inside Travel, you offer self-guided trips and obviously group tours as well. So let's talk a little bit about what they entail and the differences between those two different holiday experiences.
We have, I'll start with self-guided adventures. So with our self-guided adventures, these are tailor-made. We've got example itineraries on our website, but we can chop and change them to suit exactly what your clients are looking for, whether they've got fixed departure dates that they need to work around or specific budgets or interests. Then these are a great option because they can really be customized to suit exactly what your clients are looking for, whether they've got an interest in architecture or traditional gardens. All of these things can be kind of really indulged in with the self-guided trips. But the thing to bear in mind is that you're not going to have a guide with you for the duration of the trip. It's not like fully escorted. So although we can include days with private guides, you are still going to have a lot of independent sightseeing, and you will be traveling between destinations independently. So we'll book all of the train tickets or bus travel, whichever way is the best to get between A and B. And you will be then navigating your way through the train stations, hopping on the bullet trains yourself, and then getting off at your destination and finding your way to your accommodation. I know that can sound incredibly daunting, particularly for Japan where there's a language barrier, but we provide really comprehensive documentation for all of our self-guided trips. You'll have information in both English and Japanese. You'll have a sort of a day-by-day run through of your itinerary, so it makes it as straightforward as possible and as easy as possible for you to travel around without feeling terrified. but we do also have a customer experience team. We've got offices in Japan, so should you ever need any assistance while you are traveling, then they're always on hand to help, whether that's for finding a way to the right platform in a train station, all the way through to relocating misplaced purses or passports, heaven forbid you should leave them anywhere, and then also all the way through to kind of medical emergencies as well. And then with the small group tours, these are set itineraries, and we've got 11 different tour options to choose from, and they all range from different budgets. So you've got your kind of more basic 3-star level, which gives you plenty of time to explore independently, but you're still traveling with the comfort of group and a tour leader, all the way up through to our All in Japan tour, which is our take on an all-inclusive tour. And the real benefit of the small group tours is if you've got any nervous travelers who don't want to be navigating their way through Japanese train stations, a bit too scared to jump on the bullet trains independently, they've got the comfort of traveling with a group. Now, they are still small sizes. So most of our small group tours are just 14 people maximum. So it's very far removed from the image of everyone jumping off a coach, following a flag. we like to really kind of steer clear of that. And our kind of whole ethos is really getting beneath the surface of the destination that you visit. So with the small group tours, you're still traveling by public transport. And one of the biggest draws to these small group tours are our insider guides. And these are the people who lead the tours. They've lived in Japan for a number of years. They speak Japanese fluently. They've made their lives in Japan. And they've got such an interesting take on Japanese culture, customs. I always liken them to encyclopedias. They just know an obscene amount of knowledge about all aspects of Japanese life. So if you really want to pick someone's brains and fully understand Japanese culture, then there is often no better way than with one of our small group tours and kind of really utilizing the wisdom of our tour leaders. These are fixed departure dates. There's a variety of tours for different budgets. But with the small group tours, if you wanted to stay an extra couple of nights at the start or the end of the trip, there is still the flexibility to add in those extra nights. It's just you can't sort of pick and choose things quite as much as you can with the self-guided adventures.
Something to suit all tastes for those who love their independence and perhaps the challenge of navigating around Japan, but still with some obviously assistance and guidance, that's great. But then maybe for solo travelers or people that lack confidence or maybe just want to make new friends and, as you said, really take advantage of the guide's expertise and knowledge, and I'm sure they leave these experiences feeling so fully immersed in the Japanese culture and having such a great understanding of the place that they have visited and the people and the food and know it inside out. So it's easy to see which would suit which kind of person and traveler, but it's great that there's something to suit budgets and different tastes as well.
Yeah, definitely. And just a final point with the small group tours is we do actually have a couple of specialist tours as well. So if you've got people who want to explore the winter wonderland of Hokkaido in January, February, then we've got a winter highlights tour. So then and we've also got one called Hidden Japan, which explores the region of Shikoku, which is all hidden temples and shrines and incredibly rural. So the itineraries themselves for the small group tours aren't just, I suppose, cookie cutter type trips. They do have lots of different exciting itineraries that try to give a good twist on Japan so that you can explore lots of different aspects of Japanese scenery and Japanese culture.
Amazing. And I'm really interested to know, Holly, a little bit more about the climate and the weather in Japan and times of year to go. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Japan is in the Western Hemisphere, same as UK and Europe. So the seasons follow the same linear pattern as we experience over here. It is an all-year-round destination. There's pros and cons to each time of year. So we're currently in the midst of cherry blossom season in Japan. So I'd say spring tends to be the most popular time of year for people to visit. But what people don't necessarily realize or know is that the cherry blossoms themselves are actually only in bloom for 7 to 10 days. So it's such a short window in which you can see them. And everyone's scrambling to try and travel at this exact time. The weather patterns change each year. You never know exactly if you'll be guaranteed to see them or not. And trips can be really expensive. So usually the last week of March and the first week of April, those are the busiest 2 weeks for travel in Japan for spring. But if you've got clients who want to travel in spring, they're happy with avoiding the cherry blossoms, perhaps, then you can travel from sort of mid-February through to mid-March. And it is a little bit quieter, a little better value for money. I just think that spring is incredibly popular. It's getting more popular year upon year. But the downside of that is that it's just so busy. And you think of all of these beautiful shrines and temples. And what you don't think about are the sort of thousands of other people all hustling around you to see them. So it can kind of take away from the magic a little bit in that respect. But then you've also got the summer months in Japan. So summer in Japan is incredibly hot and humid. You'll find that the temperatures might only be sort of mid-30s, but the humidity, particularly the further south you go, can reach upwards of sort of 80, 90%. So terrible if you've got curly hair.
I was just thinking
absolutely terrible for looking put together.
That's me. Frizzy mess.
Yep, same here. So not for the faint-hearted, but there are some benefits to traveling in the summer months. It is a bit quieter. You'll find that lots of different towns and districts of cities will have their own festivals, and Japanese festivals are such a great experience. You've got usually kind of people dressed up in summer kimonos. There's street food stalls lining the road. It's a real kind of party atmosphere. There's usually some sort of choreographed dance or procession. I never fully understood the history and significance behind each individual festival I went to, but they were always a great amount of fun. So that's the summer months. But just to bear in mind with the summer is that Japan does get affected by typhoons. So if you are traveling in the summer months, similar to hurricane season in Florida, I'd say you're not guaranteed to have any adverse weather, but there is the possibility of tropical storms when you're there. Again, going back to our customer support team, amazing at handling or rerouting anyone should they need, but the majority of time the storms tend to fizzle out before they make landfall. Then you've got autumn, and I'd say autumn is our second most popular time of year to travel, and it's my personal favourite because the scenery is so beautiful. You'll find that particularly in the countryside, the autumn leaves are going for like dramatic yellows, oranges, reds. And if you like hiking, if you like being outdoors and nature, then this is one of the best times to go. Quite different from the cherry blossom period, where you've got a seven to 10 day window to see the cherry blossoms. The autumn leaves are usually at their best for kind of six weeks or so. So it's a much wider window in which to travel. And it's not as damp and miserable as we have in the UK. You'll find that the temperatures will still be in the mid to high teens. So even in October through to the end of October, it's still relatively warm in Japan. So if you do want to see the autumn leaves at their best, then usually traveling from late October through to mid November will give you the best window in which to enjoy the scenery. And then winter, which is probably the most underrated time of year to visit. Winters in Japan are crisp, cold and dry. So you tend to have blue skies and sunshine, just a little bit chillier. But usually I always say, no matter what time of year you're traveling to Japan, always bring lots of different layers, because one day or one area, it might be 23 degrees and then you go into the mountains and it's 12. So always make sure you've got your layers with you. But winter's much quieter, so you can enjoy a lot of Japan without the crowds and without a lot of the premium prices as well. And one of Japan's favorite things to do, or Japanese people's favorite things to do, is to soak away in hot spring baths. And bathing is such a ritual in Japan, and in the winter it's the best time to do it, because I don't know about you, but when it's like 34 degrees and 80% humidity outside, the last thing I want to be doing is stewing in a bath. But when it's a nice 7 degrees and blue skies and sunshine, you're surrounded by nature, then it is the perfect thing to be doing. So yeah, pros and cons to each time of year. We're always happy to give our advice to either yourselves or to clients on when's the best time to travel, and also when's the best value to travel as well. Understand that families tend to be a bit more limited to school holidays, but for anyone who's not restricted by school holidays, there's so many different options to choose from.
You beautifully explained all of that, Holly. Thank you so much. You just set the scene. I was drifting off in my own mind then, imagining the cherry blossoms and then the autumn leaves and then the blue skies in winter. So yes, they're, like you say, so many different options to consider. And if people, again, are considering their budgets as well, like you said, can look at perhaps going in off peak times and having all of those benefits of more of the place to yourself.
Yeah, definitely. And I think one of the other things about winter is because it's crisp and clear, you're more often or you're more likely to get uninterrupted views of Mount Fuji. In the summer months or spring, it can be a bit hazy. So Mount Fuji is famously known as a shy mountain. It's constantly shrouded in cloud. And in the winter months, it's when you usually get the best views.
And those bright blue skies and crisp days are what we all long for in the UK winter. And they're so few and far between. So if that's what you tend to expect in a Japanese winter, I think having that bright sunshine still has that nice feel-good factor, doesn't it? Even if the temperatures are a little bit on the cooler side, just seeing blue skies and sunshine, I think automatically lights everything up. Your photographs will look beautiful, you'll feel happy, and being outdoors will just be a delight, won't it?
Yeah, no one has to know that you're bundled up in a hat and scarf. You can have the illusion of it being the peak of summer, but yeah, I think that's one of the biggest things that we're missing in winters in the UK is that it's just grey and miserable.
Grey and dull.
Whereas Japan tends to be a bit brighter, a bit more to life.
Brilliant. Holly, I know we've already covered quite a lot about the culture, but I'm just interested to go a little bit deeper with this and find out, obviously, more differences, but what about the similarities between Japan and the UK?
I think that's one of the things everyone thinks of Japan as this other world and everything is so different. But there are a lot of similarities as well. They're an incredibly polite culture, and I think that traditionally the British are also incredibly polite, so we've definitely got a lot of shared respect, and in some respects we're also quite reserved. I know in Japan you see all of these kind of crazy inventions and all of these crazy robotics and think, what a wacky country. But actually, most people that you meet and most of your daily interactions, everyone is incredibly polite and quite often very, very shy. So I think actually the UK and British people can be a bit more outgoing, a bit more outspoken than Japanese people that you'll meet in a sort of day-to-day life. They're quite guarded with their opinions and quite guarded with their responses to things. So although they're always incredibly friendly, incredibly polite, so happy and willing to go out of their way to help you, I did find that in 2 years of living there, it was quite difficult to fully get to know who someone was and what they were all about, what kind of really made them tick. And I think particularly for Westerners, we're quite inquisitive and we're always asking questions and looking to delve a little bit further beneath the surface. But with Japan or with Japanese people, a lot of it tended to be a bit more surface level interactions. So it was really easy to make friends and really easy to have kind of fantastic interactions with people, but could often be a little bit more difficult to truly, truly know them.
That's really interesting. Holly, I'm just interested, do you speak the language now, or have you just learned the key phrases, the kind of need to know?
It's a bit of a mixed response. So when I lived there, of course, in the area that I lived, it was so rural, nobody particularly spoke any English. So I very quickly had to get to grips with learning Japanese. So I know a lot of the key phrases, but I was also able to make friends and to sort of go about my daily life without needing too much help from other people. It's been sort of 7 or 8 years since I've lived in Japan. And when you're not listening to it every day and you're not using it every day, you do tend to sort of lose a lot of the conversational ability. But I'd always say I can listen and understand more than I can read and write. I've probably got the reading comprehension of a toddler, if not any worse. So... but when I go, I can do your basics. I can make friends. I can order chicken. I can order beer.
There you go.
What more do you need?
That is all you need. Holly, now I know Japan is famous for its quirks and its quirky experiences. Are there anything in particular that springs to mind that you might recommend that people check out when they go there?
There are so many different things. It's hard to pick one, but I think one thing that is really wacky and out there is in Osaka, you can do sort of, I suppose it's like ninja school training. So you can learn the ways of a ninja, learn how to throw the little daggered spit things, all sorts of different martial arts that you can do. Japan isn't just karate, it's not just judo. There's lots of different types of martial arts that you can participate in. So we've got all sorts of kind of weird and wonderful classes that you can do. And then there's also things like, it's got a lot of kind of very immersive art galleries and museums. So one thing that's quite quirky, you've probably seen images of it all over places like Instagram, is a museum called Teen Lab, and that's based in Tokyo. And it's very, very immersive, lots of kind of bright lights and colors. You've got kind of various different rooms that you explore your way through. One of them is, I guess I can only describe it as like a swimming pool. You like wade through the water and they're projection mapping all of these images onto the water. So lots of really cool, quirky, out there type things that you can do. There used to be the robot restaurant that closed down during the pandemic. So a lot of the kind of more wacky things that used to be get a lot of media attention have actually kind of simmered down post pandemic. But you've also got lots of different themed rooms. So some accommodations will have Pokemon themed rooms or rooms like, I'm not even joking, there's all the cutlery and all of the bedding is kind of Pokemon themed. Or you've got rooms which are designed by different artists. So there's certain rooms where there's like a sumo wrestler looming over you. So all sorts of quirky things you can still do.
Just
your average day out. So it just really depends on what your interests are and kind of what you really want to see and do and how weird you want to go.
We'll leave that up to the individuals to decide, but it's great that fun factor is there, and I love it, and people can indulge in it if they wish, which is great. Holly, I have loved our conversation. I am itching to get on a flight to Japan. I can't tell you how much this conversation has inspired me and been so informative, and I'm sure the listeners feel the same. But before you leave us, can you just perhaps give us your top 5 tips for anybody who's planning a trip to Japan?
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly hard to narrow it down to just 5, but I'll try and keep it simple. I've already touched on food, but I think Japanese food is just so phenomenal. So do try all the food. Ask questions later. Just go ahead and try it. You never quite know what you're going to discover. You might find your new favorite food is some obscure sea creature that you've never even considered eating before. Certainly don't be afraid to try anything and everything. I also just want to say, don't worry about the language barrier. I know that Japan can feel daunting because it's so different from everywhere else. But there is a lot of signage in English. Some of the best interactions can come through just gesturing your way through a train station. So don't be too concerned about not speaking Japanese fluently or not everyone being able to speak English. There's usually, where there's a will, there's a way. And you do have kind of really fantastic resources with all of our travel documentation to make it as straightforward as possible for you. I think in the modern world, we can get really hung up on planning everything down to a T. We won't go to a restaurant or we won't go somewhere unless it's been recommended on Google Maps or if it's on TripAdvisor. But there's so much magic in still getting lost in translation, whether you're just not looking at a map, just wandering around a district, going down a little side street through sort of inconspicuous looking door, and then you just discover the most amazing cocktail bar or the most amazing kind of a ramen restaurant. So I really urge people to still kind of have that sense of adventure and to properly get lost when they are in Japan, because you really will discover some of the best places by doing so. My fourth tip would be to plan ahead for Japan. Japan's such a busy destination, and it can get incredibly full at certain times of the year. So the further ahead you plan, the better your travel experience will be. You'll have better quality of accommodations, better quality of guides, and also just better value. So always kind of urge people to plan ahead. It's not somewhere that you can sort of plan in 2 weeks and travel 2 weeks later. It just won't be the experience that you want it to be. And then my final tip would be to really get off the beaten track. I think Japan's become so much more popular in the past few years. So although there are lots of key destinations in which to visit, sometimes it's good to just put your faith in the people planning your holiday, and to go for a destination that's maybe a little bit more obscure, that you've not heard of, that you don't know too much about, because there's so many amazing areas to explore. And just because it's not as famous as Tokyo or not as famous as Kyoto doesn't mean that it has any less to offer. So always kind of have that sense of adventure and be brave enough to explore somewhere that you don't know that much about.
Excellent, Holly. Well, you've been a fountain of knowledge. If this is what we can expect from you, I can only imagine how knowledgeable your tour guides are, because it just feels like you know it all, and it's been...
Oh, they put me to shame.
Well, I mean, it's just so fascinating to hear all of your insights, experiences. I've just been immersed in everything that you're saying. It's been great to talk to you. And I just wanted to ask actually about the flights from the UK. What does that look like?
Yeah, so flying from the UK, there's only one direct option. So that's flying from London Heathrow into Tokyo. Tokyo's got two different airports, Tokyo Haneda and Tokyo Narita. There are direct options into both. And you can fly with British Airways or Japan Airlines or ANA, which are all Nippon Airlines. Those are the three carriers who will give you direct flights. The flight time is a little on the long side. It's 14 hours. So pre-Ukraine war, it was just under 12, but they've had to adjust their flight patterns and paths. So it now is a little bit longer, edging at sort of 14 hours. But if you've got clients who are wanting to fly from regional airports or want to look at something, different flight options rather than the direct timings, then there are lots of different indirect options as well, whether that's through Europe with someone like Finnair connecting in Helsinki or KLM in Amsterdam. But then a lot of the Middle Eastern carriers as well will also connect in places like Dubai and Abu Dhabi. So loads of different flight options to choose from. And quite often the indirect options can open the doors to flying into different regional airports in Japan as well. Of course, Tokyo is the main central hub, but you do have quite big international airports in places like Osaka as well. So lots of different options, just depends on what fits around your client's itineraries.
The choice is yours, Holly. Thank you so much. Thank you. It's been wonderful to chat to you. And thank you so much for listening. I really hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as I have. If you have been inspired like me, please do get in touch with your Not Just Travel consultant, and they can connect you to help you plan a trip with Inside Travel, taking care of all of your needs for your next visit to Japan or your first ever visit to Japan. If you don't have a Not Just Travel consultant, do not worry. Just head to our website. We have a postcode tracker there for you. Just pop in your postcode and we will connect you with your local travel consultant who will be ready and waiting to help you plan that magical trip to Japan. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you next week.